It is Wednesday. It is June 13th. You are tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and co-host Susan Bruce. A little overcast. That's our weather right now. I'm hoping please got a little rain. I don't want to water anymore. Anyway, now that we know the weather and we know the date, now we get to go to Susan, who will give us, I think, a nugget from history. Yes?
Well, this is the history of a woman.
Oh.
Yes.
A twofer.
Well, yeah, you can look at it that way. Marjorie Stoneman was born in Minneapolis, an only child. Her mother was a concert violinist. Hmm. Her father was kind of a failed entrepreneur. Hmm. Her parents separated when she was six, and her mother moved Marjorie to her family home in Taunton, Mass., where they lived with some of her mother's aunts and Marjorie's grandparents. They did not get along, this group of people.
Okay.
They badmouthed her father a lot, which was upsetting to Marjorie.
Right.
And her mother was considered high-strung and was institutionalized several times.
Ooh.
So Marjorie did not have an easy time of it as a child, which is probably why she got into reading obsessively and writing. She started writing when she was really young. When she was a teenager, awarded a prize by the Boston Globe for a story that she wrote.
Wow.
She went on to college. She was a straight A student at Wellesley.
Okay.
Graduated with a BA in English and joined a suffrage club while she was there.
Ooh.
During her senior year on a trip home, her mother showed her a lump that she had on her breast. Marjorie arranged for her to have surgery to have it removed, but it was too late. Within months, she died.
Okay.
And so by that time, she was pretty much rootless, and she met a guy and got married within 3 months to Kenneth Douglas, who told her that he was a newspaper editor. He turned out to be a con man. And his scheme to scam her father actually brought her father back into her life, and he persuaded her to ditch the con man and move to Miami.
The father. Okay.
So she...
Miami. Now we get Marjorie Stoneman to Florida. That's how I'm watching
Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Stoneman Douglas. That's right, because she married that
because
guy.
Because now she's married to the con man.
Right.
Her father had married a descendant of Thomas Jefferson, Lila Shine, who Marjorie described as her first and best friend in Florida.
Wow. So she really did have a reconnection with her father.
Yes.
And her father felt like he found someone to love.
Yes.
Okay.
So Marjorie became a writer. She worked for the Miami Herald for years, went off to freelance for a while, wrote one-act plays for the Miami Theater.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1940s, she was approached to write a book for a series called The Rivers of America. They wanted her to write about the Miami River, which she said wasn't worthy of a whole book, but she persuaded them to allow her to write about the Everglades instead.
Oh.
And so she wrote The Everglades, River of Grass, which sold out in a month of its first printing. It is still considered the definitive reference on the plight of the Everglades. It was published in 1947.
Wow.
It has been compared to Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring.
I didn't know anything about this woman.
She was amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
She really was. Now this is the short version.
Okay.
She was also a suffragist, an activist, a longtime conservationist, a charter member of the first Southern chapter of the ACLU.
I was waiting for that. Oh, I'm so excited.
She was involved with Florida Rural Legal Services, working to protect migrant workers.
Huh.
She was just amazing. The National Parks Conservation Association has a Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Award.
Wow.
In 1933, when she was 103 years old, Bill Clinton gave her the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Wow, 103 years.
103. She donated the medal to Wellesley College.
This is an amazing story.
Parkland...
Yeah.
That is named after her, opened in 1990 when she was 100 years old. She was 108 when she died.
Wow. But, you know, I'm so glad you told the beginning of her life, because look at the struggle. Look at nobody would have expected that this woman that came out of such a
dysfunctional
family, would turn out to be such a remarkable human being and made such major contributions to society.
Absolutely.
This is such an important story to remind everyone, you know.
There's a lot that is missing from this accounting. I mean, her life was bigger than this, even.
Wow. Thank you very much. That's great. Well, now that we know a little bit about the history of that school that suffered that just horrific mass shooting, you know that I begin every show with guns, guns, guns. And today we take a little story. It's from Vice.com. And local control not, I should call this. Judge blocks ban on assault rifles in tiny Illinois town hours before it was to go into effect. And here is the story from Vice, everyone. So a judge blocked a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in the small town of Deerfield, Illinois, less than 24 hours before it was meant to go into effect. The decision, which was handed down Tuesday evening, remember this is Wednesday, in the 19th Judicial Circuit Court in Lake County, Illinois, is a small victory for gun rights groups who sued the Chicago suburb in April after it became the first municipality to ban assault weapons following the Parkland High School shooting. The Deerfield Ordinance was passed unanimously by all six board members on April 2nd. Gun groups, including the National Rifle Association of Illinois, requested a temporary restraining order against the ban while the lawsuit proceeded. Had the ban gone into effect, anyone found in possession of an assault weapon after Wednesday, July 13th, would have faced a fine of up to $1,000 per day. Ooh, this actually had some teeth. I love it. I'm pretty excited, unfortunately, said John Bach. I'm saying unfortunately. The executive director of the Illinois-based gun advocacy and lobbying group Gun Save Lives. I was bracing myself for being disappointed, but it seems the judge looked at our arguments and realized we did indeed have a fair chance at success at this. Anyway, not a good story. But an interesting quiz that I'm going to encourage you to take. So if you go to the New York Times, I believe it was, actually it's in this morning's New York Times, there is a quiz. And I'm going to ask you to take a look at the quiz and take the quiz, because our level of ignorance is going to overwhelm you when you realize how many you're going to get wrong. Here it is. Guns and America. How much do you know? So everyone, do me a favor, go to the New York Times today, June 13th. You will see this quiz. There's only, I think, 13 or 14 questions. It's not going to be a heavy lift. As soon as you answer, you get told whether it's the correct answer or the wrong answer, and then they give you the factual information to tell you what the correct answer is. I just recommend that we should all do this. Maybe, in fact, I will do this tomorrow collectively, and I'll let those of you who want to take your quiz today, and then tomorrow I will share the Q&A with you, because I think what they're trying to tell us is that the NRA has been very effective at keeping us in the dark, and that's intentional. They don't want us to study the issue. They don't want to look at the harmful effects of the issue. We can't sue manufacturers of guns. They have basically done everything to sort of support their ideology and the sale of weapons, and have really prohibited and prevented so many Democrats and Republicans. I want to let people know both sides of the aisle are terrified of the NRA, and I think it's time for us to represent the vast majority of Americans who want to take on the NRA. All right. So I'm looking at Slate.com. And I'm looking at Slate.com, and there are two articles at Slate.com that caught my attention. The first article was written a couple of days ago, and it was entitled, Mitt Romney Said Democrats Will Nominate Someone Out of the Mainstream in 2020. Nothing could be farther from the truth, says the writer of this piece. His second one was entitled, Democrats Have to Earn the Latino Vote, and Not Just by Waging a Fight Over DACA, which I totally agree with. So let me welcome to the program, and Osita, if I blow your name, please forgive me. It's Wanevu. Is that how you pronounce it?
Wanevu.
Hello?
Last name is perfect. Hi.
Oh, and the first name was wrong. And what? Yes, you're on. What's the first name?
So the first is Osita.
Osita, okay.
And yeah, last name you nailed perfectly.
Okay. So let's start with the Romney piece, because I totally agree with you that Romney is wrong by suggesting that whoever the Democrats nominate, if it's a progressive, would be nothing but out of the mainstream. And I think that that's an absolute falsehood. And let me just tell you, before we get into your article, I want to just share something that I use as my nugget of information. Every time there is a referendum, whether it's in a red state or a blue state, to increase the minimum wage, it doesn't matter what the politicians are saying, it doesn't matter what the business community is saying, every single time it has appeared before voters, it has passed. It has passed. And I mean, yep, in the reddest of red states and the bluest of blue states. So that kind of tells me that the people are on one path and the politicians are on another.
I think that's absolutely true, and that minimum wage polling goes back years and years and years. Back in the 2000s, you saw basically the same thing as far as I can remember. But the most recent polling that I mentioned in the piece shows that we have solid majorities across the country for raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Actually, one of the polls that I used in the piece came from Third Way, which is a centrist think tank that actually opposes a $15 national minimum wage. And their own polling shows that a 51% majority of Americans want it. So, you know, this goes to what I was saying in the piece. I think Republicans have a very warped idea of what the mainstream of American politics is for a couple of reasons. One is it's easier for them to win presidential elections because of the Electoral College. We saw that in November 2016, obviously. But also, you know, the United States Senate is structured in a way that gives a lot of power to smaller, more conservative states. And that sort of has built a floor level of Republican power that sort of tells them or makes them believe that, you know, we're winning all these elections because the people are really kind of center-right. If you actually ask the American people on policy issues what they want to have happen, what they actually support, it's consistently Americans will support liberal policies. And that's also in spite of what a lot of people look at, which is self-ID polling. If you ask Americans, are you a liberal, are you conservative, or are you a moderate, most Americans will say they're either conservatives or moderates, which doesn't mesh with the actual policy preferences we know that they have, if you actually ask them about specific positions. And that's because, you know, liberalism has given such a bad rap in American politics for so long that people have negative associations with it. People think more positively about conservatism as sort of a term or independence from partisanship.
So many years ago, I'm an old woman, and many years ago I read a book by E.J. Dionne entitled Why Americans Hate Politics. And I believe he wrote it in 1991. I think it was revised in 2000. I think he should rewrite it for 2018, to be honest with you. But one of the things I learned from E.J., and this I think is so true, and I'm going to damn Democrats, and I'm a Democrat who's been a politician, so I feel like I have the right to do this. And that is that what I believe, and this is what I learned from E.J., is that Americans are operationally liberal and philosophically conservative. And so they imagine themselves, you know, if you ask them about family and about change, they have this sort of conservative packaging that they have. But then they have this liberal expectation. They want their streets cleaned. They want their teachers there when they need them. They want their health care affordable. They want to be able to send their kids to college and not go bankrupt. When you go through all the liberal things that they actually would embrace to make their lives better, to make their communities more stable, they want liberal things. They don't want the marketplace to do it. They want it done, you know? And part of the problem, I think, isn't just that Republicans, you know, have this mindset about what they think, you know, Americans want, and they're maybe able to show that a lot of times Americans vote against their own self-interest. But I'm going to blame Democrats, because Democrats are afraid of the term liberal. Democrats are afraid to say, look what government brought you. You know, government brought you this bridge. Government brought you that road. Government brought you that higher educational facility. Government brought you that doctor when you needed it. They are afraid to create the connection between policy, government, and what improves people's lives. And if Democrats are running away from it and Republicans are crowing about the opposite, then guess what? Americans don't really understand that the term liberal is really what they would embrace if they recognize that term meant these various sort of policy statements.
I think that's absolutely true. I think one of the famous phrases of the Obama years was, hands off my Medicare, you know, being, you know, shouted by people who were part of the Tea Party and were anti-government health care, so they thought, but they really, really like their Medicare and they want to keep it. You know, I think the easiest thing, or what should be the easiest thing to do in politics is point to your successes and say, here's what I did. I will keep doing this and more if you continue to support me and my party. And Democrats, for whatever reason, and I think that you know, people will disagree about the reasons, but for whatever reason, they're very reluctant to do this. We saw this, for example, with the stimulus in the past, you know, early in the Obama years. Unless you passed by a bridge with one of those signs saying, you know, this was done by the Recovery Act, you're very hard-pressed to find actual, you know, the impact of what was done. Because Obama didn't really crow about it in the way that I think that he should have. This was something that saved the economy. But, you know, again and again and again, I think we see this in liberal policy because people have been, or Democrats have been so afraid, as you said,
Let's understand why. Let's understand why. We have Reagan who said, you talked about government being the problem, right? That was Reagan.
Right.
But let me remind everyone what Bill Clinton said. The era of big government is over. Bill Clinton was a new Democrat. A new Democrat was a moderate Republican. Let's be honest here. So what we saw with Bill Clinton is that if there was a spectrum, the spectrum moved to the right because the Democrats under Bill Clinton for 8 years was kind of a Republican wet dream. I mean, he delivered for the Republican Party all the things the Republican Party had dreamt about but weren't able to accomplish. And what do I mean by that? Welfare reform, criminal justice reform, repeal of Glass-Steagall, deregulation of derivatives. I mean, if I told you that that was happening under a Democratic administration, you would put me on a couch. If that's and he was considered sort of he could have been reelected for a third term. I mean, if I hear that from Democrats one more time, I mean, the Monica Lewinsky thing, the impeachment thing, the fact that he lied, that none of that has anything to do with what they wanted to do, which is embrace him, which to a large extent really kind of explains Donald Trump today, because Trump, in a bizarre way, is a little bit like Bill Clinton on steroids.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you see that both in terms of his own sort of cultural affinity he's built with the white working class, but also the fact that originally, before he became president, he was sort of willing to triangulate it on certain positions that, you know, which scared the Republican Party because they didn't want people saying, their candidates saying, well, you know, maybe the government should have a role in health care. And Bill Clinton did the same thing on our end. He embraced Republican policy positions, cut welfare, you know, tough on crime.
Exactly.
You know, during the 92 campaign, made sure he went back to Arkansas to make sure a mentally ill African-American man was executed to demonstrate, you know, that he was tough on crime.
I forgot about that. That's right, he did. Oh, my God. Oh.
And, you know, I remember, you know, when I was growing up in the 2000s, this very rosy picture of the 90s that Democrats love to paint. They did it in advance of 2006 as evidence that, you know, moderate policy is what was going to win them elections. All we have to do is do what Bill Clinton did. You know, I think what they did won in 2006, you know, we won in 2008. But the thing is, if you fill out your majorities with those kinds of Democrats, when it comes time to pass something like the Affordable Care Act, for instance, some large scale, you know, reinvention of the healthcare system, you're going to be undermined by those people who don't really share the same goals, who are more into market solutions than the Democratic Party voters are, and most of the Democrats who are serving are. It's inherently self-defeating, but again and again and again, we see this in the lead up to the midterms now, Democrats fall back on this strategy, in part because I think that Democrats, you know, who run the party are sort of genuinely invested in market solutions to things, but also because it's what's convenient. Like, of course, you know, it seems like it'd be easier to win a redder district with somebody who tacks closer to the center. And maybe you win, you know, in November doing that across the country. But if you actually want to build power for the party and pass all this ambitious legislation that people actually want, that's going to bite you in the end.
Well, you know, I've told this story before, but I was a fellow at Harvard, and in 1997, they gave me Bella Abzug's office. That was the office that I was assigned. And I actually used a quote from Bella as one of the titles of my class. And here's what Bella said. You have to lose, lose, lose to win. Mm-hmm. And she didn't see loss as a horrific thing. She saw loss as an opportunity to learn. She saw loss as an opportunity to grow a base. She saw loss as a way to sort of start creating connection and relationship. And the reason why I am so frightened by this sort of idea by the Democrats that are sort of in control or in charge, people like Nancy Pelosi. What's Nancy Pelosi's claim to fame other than she's been there since dirt? And her claim to fame is she can outraise any Democrat. Well, if she can outraise any Democrat, where do you think she gets her money? She's not getting her money from you. She's not getting her money from me, but she is getting her money from big business. She is getting her money from people that basically want a more moderate Republican response that doesn't necessarily reflect what the needs of the American people are, but it definitely keeps them well-heeled, in a profit mode, with very little expectation or regulation. And so in an ironic way, the reason why Nancy Pelosi is the worst example of what the Democrats can have to have someone in charge is not because she's a weapon that the Republicans use against us, but she's actually a weapon against our growing a future.
I think that's true. And I want to go back to the quote that you just said, because I think it's important. You know, you have to lose in order to win. One of the examples, you know, that I mentioned in the Mitt Romney piece is the campaign of 1964. Barry Goldwater running against Lyndon Johnson.
Beautiful. Keep going. Tell that story.
You know, I like telling this story because I think it's fundamental to understanding what actually drives change in American politics. So Barry Goldwater is absolutely destroyed by Johnson in the general election, just across the country. Some of the worst electoral defeats in American history. And Goldwater, of course, was one of the first major candidates to fully embody conservatism as we understand it now. And people said after he lost, you know, well, this proves that this is too far. The mainstream Americans like their governments. Americans like government programs, great society, you know, it's Kennedy and all that. And, you know, this was supposed to demonstrate that conservatism wouldn't have a future in American politics. It would have been very easy for the Republican Party to shut out conservative activists and say, you know, we tried that way and we're going to go keep doing the same thing we've been doing. But what actually happened is conservative activists, a lot of the changes that were happening in the 60s, saw reaction on the part of Americans who weren't comfortable with that change and began laying sort of infrastructure to turn that dissent and turn that discomfort into political power. And it took a lot of money, you know, from corporate interests, but it also took, you know, pundits who emerged during this time, different publications, different groups that were organized in
They built the conservative infrastructure to support the conservative ideology. They accepted a couple of years of loss because they didn't look at they didn't look at the immediate loss as a permanent loss. They looked at the immediate loss and said, well, in 2 years, in 4 years, in 6 years, and they had a vision for the future. The Democrats, for whatever reason, someday I'm going to write my book, and the title of my book is A Spine is a Terrible Thing to Waste. And what the Democrats have shown over and over again is that they are afraid, and people can smell the fear. And if you really believe that your policies will work, and if you think they will make a difference in people's lives, if you think that they will actually improve the country for the future, not just for the 1% or the 5%, for the 10%, but for the 90%, and the 10% will still do well, then you've got to really sort of live and die on that idea, saying, I believe this because I can show you how it'll make a difference. And eventually, I think if they get in power saying that, they'll be able to deliver. But if they say nothing and they win, then they have a mandate to do nothing.
Right. I think that's true.
So we only have a couple minutes left. Your second piece was about the Latino vote. And, you know, obviously, we've been talking a lot about DACA. Right now, we're talking a lot about what's happening at the border with the separation of families and Jeff Sessions. So what is the message to the Latino voter? Because you point out in your piece that in 2016, there was actually a less of a voter turnout for Hillary Clinton or for, in this case, even Donald Trump than in previous years. So we didn't obviously find some kind of connection to bring them into the fold to actually exercise the franchise. Oh, my goodness. All right, everyone, I apologize for that. But we got a tremendous amount of information out of him. Can I just say something, Susan? So he writes for Slate, and he's incredibly knowledgeable. He's a very good storyteller. He's a very good policy teller. So you know what I realize? That because I look at Mark Joseph Stern that we also get from Slate, there is something thematic about what Slate is looking for in the people that write for them, that they write well, that they're historically based, that they're not afraid of really sort of putting together a complement of information and history, so that when they respond to what Mitt Romney says by suggesting that the Democrats are going to, you know, nominate someone who is, you know, out of the mainstream of the American people, they don't just respond to that quote, but they give you a history lesson in order to understand why Romney is wrong, not only for the statement he makes, but if you look at the history, he is wrong. If you look at the polling data and how Americans are moving forward, he is wrong, assuming, again, as Osita said, that we build the infrastructure to support the policies. You can't just offer a policy without having another kind of sort of supporting parallel documentation.
Well, then you got to sell it. You got to sell it and sell it and sell yourself and sell the good work that you're doing.
All the time. And recognize that when something good happens, let people know
you did
it. You
should learn from Donald Trump, who's the biggest braggart on the planet.
I tell it, marketing, marketing, marketing. And on that note, a little labor history is next on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and co-host Susan Bruce.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1926. That was the day union leader Tony Mazzocchi was born. He's remembered as a longtime leader and international official with the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union. Mazzocchi was a prime force behind the passage of the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970. He was also centrally involved in the grievances Karen Silkwood brought against the Kerr-McGee Company. During the 1990s, he worked tirelessly to establish a labor party as an independent political force that could truly represent working people. Mazzocchi was born in Brooklyn, New York, to a union family. After fighting in World War II, he hired on at a cosmetics factory organized by the Gas Workers Union. He quickly emerged as a leader, fought for the rights of women workers, and soon became the president of his local. He would go on to aid in the merging of his union with the Oil Workers International that created OCAW. Within 10 years, he had become the International's Citizenship Legislative Director. Many have noted that Mazzocchi was one of the first labor leaders to build ties with the environmental movement. He linked the hazards in the workplace with hazards in the environment. He showed how workers and the public shared similar concerns about health and safety. He pioneered the Blue-Green Alliance that continues to advocate for green blue-collar jobs, build union reading clubs, and pushed his members toward social justice unionism. Mazzocchi was a coalition builder and worked with allies for clean water and air, single-payer health care, free education, and just trade policies. The United Steelworkers named their Health, Safety, and the Environment Center in his honor. He died in 2002 of pancreatic cancer. He was 76 years old.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Another day, another mass shooting at another school. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute, this time in Santa Fe, Texas. And so one more time, America is debating the Second Amendment, which says, quote, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The Second Amendment was interpreted by the Supreme Court in 2008 in the Heller case. There, the court found that the words about a militia didn't mean much of anything and ruled that the Second Amendment created an individual right to guns. But that right, according to the majority opinion written by Justice Scalia, is not unlimited. Quote, nothing in this opinion shall be taken to cast doubt on the long-standing prohibitions on the possession of firearms by the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places, such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms, end quote. And so, while it is absolutely correct that gun laws in the United States now must be governed by the Second Amendment and some things remain undecided, it is also true that many gun safety laws proposed in recent years are not prohibited by that constitutional provision. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take been working in this factory for now 15 years. All this time I watched my woman drowning in a pool of tears. And I've seen a lot of good folk die, had a lot of bills to pay. I'd give the shirt right off of my back if I had the guts to say, take this job and shove it, I ain't working here no more. My woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it, I ain't working here no more.
Ah, don't you love the attitude with Arnie Arneson? So, of course, Susan Bruce, my co-host on The Attitude, always manages to find a song that is somewhat thematic with the topic at hand. So remind the audience, Take This Job and Shove It is sung by...
Johnny Paycheck.
Oh,
you know,
God.
I looked around at job songs and I hate my job songs and I couldn't find anything I liked better. This was my original impulse, and sometimes you have to just go with the classics.
You gotta go with the classics. Well, the title of this book probably is a classic as well. So I'm looking at the American Prospect, and we go to the American Prospect a lot. And I see an article that says, and I'm going to use the initials, I'll be good, Sean, Take This BS Job and Pretend to Love It. And it's a new book by David Graeber. Sean Richman writes for the American Prospect. He's an expert on workers' rights and the program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Junior Center for Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College. And I believe he lives on Staten Island, but we'll talk about that later. Anyway, let me welcome Sean to the program. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.
It's a great choice of a song, I got to say.
Yeah,
you know,
I know.
As a writer, this is the first instance I've ever had of a headline that I proposed actually getting accepted. And, you know, Harold Meyerson at The Prospect has as much of an aversion to cussing as the FCC does. But he must be a fan of the Johnny Paycheck song, too. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what are you going to do, though? Because look what the title of the book is. It's BS Jobs anyway. So, I mean, you couldn't run away from it if you tried. Let me just start by pulling a little bit of a nugget out of your article, and then we can sort of take it from there. And you write, 5 years ago, Graeber wrote an essay for the radical magazine Strike, asking why people in the United States and England are not working the 15-hour week that John Maynard Keynes had predicted would be the result of technological advancement. In our post-scarcity society, he argued only a tiny fraction of the population actually has to labor in order to provide for the material needs of all. It's as if someone were out there making up pointless jobs for the sake of keeping us all working, he wrote. The essay went viral. Millions of people read it, and thousands wrote to vent about their own pointless jobs. And then you point out that what Graeber does is he breaks down these pointless jobs into five major categories. I love the titles. Box tickers, duck tapers, taskmasters, flunkies, and goons. Wow. So let's talk a little bit about this pointless job concept. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out, you know, I look at the title of the different sort of levels of pointless jobs, but give me an idea of what you think he means, because I am looking at so many jobs that we need to do that aren't being done. And I'm trying to figure out, so why are people being diverted into pointless jobs when there's so much that has to be accomplished because of things like climate change and an aging demographic and what's happening in education? And I'm like, oh my God, to waste time and energy doing something that is not of value.
Well, I mean, it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, this is the private sector. This is corporate America that's creating these jobs. And so there's not, you know, they don't have as much of an interest in putting jobs into, fixing the environment. But the ballooning of these sorts of jobs is sort of strange, because it goes hand in hand with the sort of extreme exploitation of lower wage workers. You've got corporations that will treat the people that do the real work that earns them their profits like utter garbage, and squeeze as much time out of them for as little money as possible, and then just lets this sort of ranks of sort of white collar professionals with no real portfolio of responsibilities proliferate. And Graeber, you know, those five categories are broken down into sort of the phenomena that gets the jobs created. One of the jobs, the box checker, is a good example of you know, and this happens a lot. You know, you've got, you know, if there's like a large class action suit and a big pot of money is one, it's in the interest of the firm that is doling that money to build up as much administrative expenses as possible,
right,
for themselves, you know, to sort of forestall the payout to the people who deserve the money. And so these jobs get created to, you know,
to siphon off.
Just creating their own layers of bureaucracy and documentation so that, you know, you've got staff people who are just like, okay, so did we do this today? Good. Did we do this today? Good. Did we do this today? Good. And now they've done their 20 minutes of work for the day, and they have to look busy for the rest of the day.
Well, you know, let me just say something. I've been thinking about a pointless job, and here's what I decided is a pointless job. So I was talking to a friend of mine who is a doctor, and 40 years ago, who he had in his staff was he might have had someone at the front desk, and then he had his nurse, and it was, and usually it's a male doctor. And so the staff was pretty limited, but they basically were there to do medical care, all right? They were in the business of health care. Now his office has ballooned to 20 people, of which most of them are not doing health care. Most of them are on the phone talking to the insurance company, talking to the hospital, talking to the pharmacy, talking to this. They're not doing anything that really relates to healthcare. What they are paper pushers. They're doing all this stuff that has nothing to do with why you, I mean, can you imagine saying to your child, when you grow up, you're going to be working to take care of people's insurance? Like, that's not a job that seems very fulfilling to me. It's like, oh, yuck. But yet that is the vast majority of people he employs. And that is got nothing to do with feeling accomplished or feeling like you've resolved someone's health issues. You just feel like basically you've sort of had to check, as you point out, the boxes.
That's a perfect example of it. And you know, there's this centrist talking point out there against Medicare for All. It says, like, you know, the people that acknowledge that there actually would be cost savings if we switched to a single-payer system, but are against it anyway, will point to the millions of jobs at health insurance companies and in medical billing and processing that would be lost. And that's a crazy reason to maintain a system that is literally killing people.
Exactly. But let me just say something, though. So that's one of the reasons why they're angry at single payer or Medicare for All, because it would be too efficient. And the insurance companies say, but we are so good at bloat. We are so good at profit. We are so good at costing you more money to get less health care. This is what we are good for. And you want this, as if you would want this. And so what I'm trying to figure out is, as I was reading your article and I did not get to read Graeber's book, is that what is it ultimately that we are looking for as an answer? I don't want BS jobs, but I really do think that there are plenty of jobs that will feel fulfilling, that will actually produce a positive result. And yet, for whatever reason, we've chosen to embrace the jobs that don't get us to goal, and we've turned to reject the jobs that will get us to goal.
Like teachers.
Like teachers.
We resent them for wanting to be decently paid.
Well, and we need, and think, so.
But everybody had a teacher. Everybody.
Everybody did, exactly. So what I'm trying to figure out is, where do we go? Where do we go with this? Because I want people to be employed. I also want them to feel like they've done something of value.
Well, I would argue, I mean, so Graeber grapples with the universal basic income, this idea that because there isn't actually enough meaningful work to go around, that we need to sort of decouple the need to work from your ability to put a roof over your head and have health insurance and afford food. And there's a lot of people that are looking at that as a solution problem of automation and, you know, I mean, Amazon is a job killing machine too. There's a lot of stuff
right,
like that.
Right.
I think we definitely, you know, we need to move towards a lower hours movement. 40, first of all, no, you know, people, the people who are working full-time jobs are not working 40 hours because you're still getting forced to do overtime, even in your BS job.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Which is crazy.
Exactly.
We should be moving towards 30 hours, 20 hours. But to get more meaningful jobs, I don't see a solution that doesn't involve a far more robust public sector. We need to be doing the opposite of what this Congress has done in terms of the tax breaks for the corporations. We should be taxing the bejesus out of these corporations so that they have less money to throw around on BS jobs, and we have more money to fix our infrastructure, to get meaningful health care to people in rural areas.
Right.
There are plenty of projects that need to get done that can only be done by a public sector because corporations don't want to do it. But that being said, there's still not enough meaningful work to go around for everybody to do 40 hours a week. And so we do, I think, I'm a socialist, I think as a left, we need to challenge the notion of people having to work.
But remember, here's the deal. So this is so interesting because what I see happening is that I think you're right about the 30 hours. I think that would be fabulous. But the reason why people have to work 40 hours or 50 hours or 60 hours is if the only time they get their health care is that they have to be full time. What's the definition of full time? It's not 20. Sometimes it's not 30. It's at least 32. So they can't get that necessary benefit because everyone gets sick. And then they find out that the 32 hours isn't going to be enough in the way of requisite income because it turns out that they have the copay, they have the deductible. So even though they've gotten to the 32 to get the health care, then they find out they have to work the next 8 to be able to pay for the health care that supposedly they were getting for working the 32. And then they realize that the cost of their rents are going through the roof. The cost of food is going through the roof. No one is giving them any help with transportation. So part of the drive for this additional hours isn't about the value of work, it's about the need to survive.
But much of the drive is by the employers forcing the overtime, right? And so and this actually goes back to health insurance too. When an employer is paying for employees' health insurance, that is a sunk cost. That is a chunk of money that the company has to pay for each employee.
Right.
So rather than hire an entire extra employee and pay the same sunk cost again, it is cheaper to force mandatory overtime.
You're
this happens
right.
a lot, you know, in unionized shops where there's more benefits loaded onto payroll, and so the employers they'll pay the benefits, but they want to keep the workforce as small as possible, which is working much longer hours.
Right, right. Well, you know, I was listening to Donald Trump basically sort of, you know, taking Trudeau and sort of chopping him off at the legs and talking about this guy that wants to add tariffs and taxes and all these kinds of things and how unfair the trade deficit is, which is a lie anyway with Canada. But do you remember this story? Sean, I'm such an old lady, but there was a story about Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan was complaining about the Canadians and that the Canadians had an economic advantage over the United States. Do you know what the economic advantage was?
I'm guessing it's their Medicare system.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
That was what he was saying. They have an advantage over us because they don't have to deal with the cost of health insurance because they have universal health care. And that is an economic opportunity, and therefore it is an unfair trade practice. I just want everyone to hear this. This is what Ronald Reagan said. Well, you know what? It could have sounded like Donald Trump yesterday. I mean, in a lot of ways, this is part of the complaint and the bitching and the moaning is what have they done to create a level of efficiency so that they've taken the burden off of the employer not to have to deal with this, and they can just deal with how many people they're actually needing to employ, how many dollars they're paying these individuals, because this piece of that sunk cost that you just described is not part of their economic game plan.
Yeah, while we're talking books, Lane Wyndham has an excellent book called Knocking on Labor's Door that's about how unions were really organizing in the 1970s, but that they crashed against the waves of the beginning of really sort of an open shop drive by employers.
Right.
And what was driving the open shop drive by employers was foreign competition, but not foreign competition as we tend to think of it today. It was German companies and Japanese companies first that were outcompeting the American automotive companies on the basis of health insurance. But rather than embrace, you know, Medicare for all, you know,
right.
these companies decided, well, let's just beat up on our employees and break the backs of the unions. And this is the state of the economy that we're in now because of that.
Well, let me just say something else, because Graeber's book is so interesting because it twists what people's idea of jobs are. Their understanding is the reason why you want to hire a CEO to be your governor, or the reason why you want to hire a, you know, a successful business person to be your president, is because obviously they would be efficient. Obviously, there would never be such a thing as a BS job. There would never be the box ticker or the duct taper or the whatever. They have this idea that somehow corporate America must be lean and mean and efficient, and the government
is run government like a business.
Right. And that government is about bloating and bureaucracy and 20 people to do the work of one person. And what's so interesting about this book is that it actually kind of blows up that balloon.
It's actually the reverse is true. Partly it's because of austerity. The public sector has been starved for so long.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, corporations, they're not lean and mean at all, except when it comes to the workers that are actually producing the product that's making the profits.
Right. So they have a layer of duct tapers. They have a layer of box tickers. I mean, I feel like in a lot of ways it doesn't describe the part of the expression, the grunts on the bottom that are actually doing the work. It is the idea that it's those middle management people that basically are sort of scooping up the profit but not necessarily producing anything in the way of valued results, which I think is just so fascinating. But let me just say one more thing. So, Sean, I remember sitting one day in my hairdresser's chair, and my hairdresser is a conservative Republican, and he was complaining about taxes and complaining about the government, complaining about the bureaucracy, and I knew his daughter was graduating from college. So I asked him what did he want his daughter to do or what was she going to do, and he says, God, I hope she gets a job working for the state. And yeah. I looked at him, and I said, what? Yeah. I almost fell off the chair, and I went, why would you want her to do that? And he said, oh, then she'll have a health package, and she'll have a pension plan, and she'll have just a certain number of requisite hours. He was describing something that he so valued, that he wanted, and he saw that government gave that kind of structure to someone that they employed. Now, think about this. He couldn't put two and two together, that the thing that he actually said he hated is something that he actually wanted for his kid. What does that tell you, Sean, about how do we like reinvent what is it that people value so people know how to vote that way?
I think universalism is an important element of a political platform. And, you know, we've had about 40 years of liberal Democrats or centrist Democrats in today's perspective sort of pushing, you know, what's achievable. You know, and what's achievable was often a means-tested benefit for the poor.
Right.
And you know, it's terrible. It's selfish. It's not a part of the human instinct that I want to particularly celebrate. But you know, people do get jealous of why do they got and I don't got. And I think a kind of politics that can gain mass support is one that says we all deserve this. So
yes.
We all deserve health insurance. I think if you expanded Medicare to everybody, I couldn't think of anything that would go farther to make people see a real value in government and support higher taxes and an expanded government. Or as another example, in New York City, where our Mayor de Blasio expanded pre-K. Made it universal and free. So, I mean, not only does it have tremendous educational outcomes for those students,
yep.
You're putting $12,000 in every working family's pocket.
Right.
That's 1 year that you don't have to pay very, very, very expensive child care costs.
Right.
And now he's trying to expand it to 3K. And
wow.
You know, I think that progressive candidates in the city levels around the country should be exploring that as a model. Because in one moment, the moment that your kid walks through that pre-kindergarten door, you're more of a believer in government all of a sudden than you were the day before.
Well, no, and it's an educational benefit. It's a financial benefit. It's a stable, like you're emotionally feeling more stable as a result, and everyone has access to it. It doesn't mean that the rich still won't go to some fancy pre-K, but guess what? They don't have to. just the way I don't have to. And, you know, it is creating that level playing field. And that's one of the reasons why Social Security should never be means tested. Ever, ever, ever. The idea that we all collect a Social Security check is something I will go to the mat on. And as soon as they start talking about, but why does a rich guy need Social Security? I said, because we all get it.
Everybody
just,
in.
Everybody in. Just way everybody gets to vote. What if we started means testing voting? I mean, only rich people can
vote.
We are.
After Monday's Supreme Court decision.
Doesn't that feel that way? Oh, my God, that Ohio case is just disgusting. But I want everyone to realize that there are certain things that when you give it to everyone, then what? Guess what? It sort of Velcros you together, even as a nation. That idea of that universality is also the best thing. If you're worried about patriotism and a sense of duty and a sense of obligation and a love of country, you don't divide people up. You make sure that everyone has access at the same time to the same thing. That means that's what the definition of being an American is. I really believe that. And I think that's why when I keep hearing this means testing, it is the most unpatriotic thing you could actually do. That makes sense.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's two instincts to it, right? I mean, there's the conservative one, which is it's designed to tear down the system because once you make it not universal, they know it's vulnerable. The reason Social Security has lasted as long is because everybody's paid into it and everybody expects to get their check.
Yes.
But then, you know, there's been the good liberals who have done means testing mainly as a sense of pragmatism of this is how we win it. And you know, is why you're having these battles right now between, you know, a reinvigorated left, Democratic Socialists of America, and all that, and the sort of the centrist establishment, the DCCC, and folks like that, who, you know, it's not nefarious even. It's just it's almost a disagreement over strategy, and they're having a hard time seeing that something has fundamentally changed in this country, and it is time to embrace universalism again. Because that is what's more winnable than anything that's incremental and means tested.
Well, and again, in a lot of ways, a lot of those moderate centrist Democrats are actually jealous of Republicans. They want what Republicans want. They want it easier. They don't want to raise taxes. You know, it's really so funny that they think that Republicans are more tax averse than Democrats. No. Democrats are frankly more tax averse than Republicans because there's an expectation that because they believe in government that they have to pay for it. Think about this. It's like so hilarious. So they want their cake and eat it too. They want to still be able to deliver services, but they want to do it in the cheapest way possible. So means testing gets them to that, except what it does is it undermines their future. I mean, I don't understand what the Democratic Party is doing, but BS jobs sounds like an opportunity for us to sort of look at this and realize that if corporate America is creating BS jobs, then we have something that we really have to begin to fear, because I always thought that they were more efficient, and if they're not efficient, then God help us, what are we doing? I don't know. So Farmers.
You know, I mean, farmers actually do something. They produce a product. They love what they do. But we don't value them. We value guys that sit in offices and push paper around on desks. That's who we create.
Well, but also, I mean, there's fewer people working on farms, right?
Right.
Getting back to the post-scarcity society issue, so much of what goes into food production from farm to table is automated or done by robots in ways, and so, you know, there's not a lot, you know, there's not enough work to go around.
I'm going to let you go, but I'm going to challenge you, Sean, because I believe there's plenty of work to go around. I'm looking at what's happening with climate change. I'm looking at what it's going to do, you know, from every single level. We are so damn unprepared. I mean, I don't think we're going to stop it. The question is, how do we survive it? And that survival alone is going to require so much human capital and so much opportunity for people to actually do things and work and feel accomplished. And the idea that you're saying that we should, you know, that we're not going to have enough work, there is plenty of work. The question is, do we believe in the fact that if we don't do that work, that some people will drown? And guess who will be? It'll be the people who are always on the bottom, you know, the expendable people. And if we actually do the work, then maybe we can keep people from drowning. And I just think that there's plenty of work, and I just want to figure out how to do it. So
there's a counter argument that maybe getting a couple, you know, 10 or 20, 100, you know, millions of people out of commuting to pointless jobs could actually clear the air faster, too.
Well, that may be true.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
That's an excellent. All right, real quickly, 2 minutes. What the hell is going on in Staten Island? Oh, my God. I mean, I was watching MSNBC, and then I was looking at your article. So just real quickly, there was a debate the other night. What the heck is going on?
It's an embarrassment not just to the community, but I think it's an embarrassment to the very concept of human civilization. So our ex-congressman Michael Grimm is running for his old seat. He's primarying the man who took over his job after he went to jail. He is running on a hard right-wing platform and embracing Donald Trump. Dan Donovan, our incumbent Republican congressman, is a moderate within the context of the modern Republican Party.
Right.
So still very right wing, but he has had to tack very far to the right. So it's just one horrible example. We had this incident where a pizza delivery guy was called to Fort Hamilton Army Base, which is in Bay Ridge, which is right in our district, they demanded identification so he could deliver pizza to them to eat. And they arrested him for being an undocumented immigrant, and it's become a cause célèbre around the city where almost everybody else is aghast at this and wants this man freed. But when this question comes up in their debate, Dan Donovan goes really hard on, you know, you got to follow the law. If he didn't follow the law, he should be deported. Michael Grimm doesn't even have to address that point. He just gets to bang on Donovan for how last year, you know, he was in favor of some watered-down version of the DREAM Act. So the Republican Party here is really getting dragged down and to the right by sort of national politics, by Trump and Trump's base. And the question is, does this create an opening for the Democrats on the island? This is a district that has been Republican.
Staten Island is so Republican.
One term.
Right.
There are twice as many Democrats as Republicans on Staten Island, and independents, it's an even greater number.
Wow.
The Republican Party is a minority movement, but they tend to win elections because the Democrats don't know how to run in contested races in New York City, because it's a machine here. Every other seat in the city is almost gifted. You know, it's almost inherited. So contested elections is not what they're good at. They've run some pretty boneheaded campaigns.
Well, maybe the Republicans are handing them a gift, and I need to let you go, Sean Richmond. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay.
BS Jobs. Remember that. That's the book you're looking for. All right, take care. Ciao. Bye-bye.
All right,
we're going to end with a song, The Workers' Song.